Our reading is from, our first reading is from the first book of Samuel in chapter 4, please. 1 Samuel chapter 4, and while you're finding the passage, I must say how grateful Linda and I have been for an opportunity to come back and renew some quite long-lasting friendships forged over the years, and it's been great, and I can say quite honestly before the Lord that it's been a tremendous benefit to both of us being here. We go home tomorrow, as Frank said, leaving on the Bohengi about 11. And in spite of several very kind offers, I'm not taking any frozen fish or frozen Kong fritters, but that actually took a lot of saying no to that last bit. But I do take back with me not only some memories, but some love, best wishes, greetings from many of you to James and Susanna, who, for different reasons, have no way of being here. So thank you all very much. And again, before I read our passage or passages for tonight, I'd like to say that I have got some copies with me of a sheet which I've prepared, which sets out some of the scriptural evidence for some of the things I'll be saying tonight. I have deliberately avoided providing biblical support for everything I'm going to say, but if anyone's interested, please see me afterwards and I'll gladly let you have a copy of the sheet. Our first reading is in 1 Samuel and chapter 4. And the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Now Israel went out against the Philistines to battle, and pitched beside Ebenezer, and the Philistines pitched in Aphek. And the Philistines put themselves in array against Israel. And when they joined battle, Israel was smitten before the Philistines, and they slew of the army in the field about 4,000 men. When the people were coming to the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Wherefore hath the Lord smitten us today before the Philistines? Let us fetch the ark of the covenant of the Lord out of Shiloh unto us, that when it cometh among us, it may save us out of the hand of our enemies." Verse 10. And the Philistines fought, and Israel was smitten, and they fled every man into his tent. And there was a very great slaughter, for there fell of Israel 30,000 footmen. And the ark of God was taken, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were slain. Chapter 7, verse 3, please. One Samuel 7 and 3. And Samuel spake unto all the house of Israel, saying, "If ye do return unto the Lord with all your hearts, then put away the strange gods and Ashtaroth from among you, and prepare your hearts unto the Lord, and serve him only, and he will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines." Then the children of Israel did put away Balaam and Ashtaroth, and served the Lord only. And Samuel said, "Gather all Israel to Mizpah, and I will pray for you unto the Lord." Verse 9. And Samuel took a sucking lamb and offered it for a burnt offering wholly unto the Lord. And Samuel cried unto the Lord for Israel, and the Lord heard him. And as Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, the Philistines drew near to battle against Israel. But the Lord
thundered with a great thunder on that day upon the Philistines, and discomfited them, and they were smitten before Israel. And the men of Israel went out to Mizpah, and pursued the Philistines, and smote them until they came under Bethcar. Then Samuel took a stone, and set it between Mizpah and Shen, and called the name of it Ebenezer, saying, "Hitherto hath the Lord helped us." So the Philistines were subdued, and they came no more into the coast of Israel. And the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel. Back into the book of Judges, please, in chapter 13. Book of Judges, chapter 13. And the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Philistines 40 years. And there was a certain man of Zorah, of the family of the Danites, whose name was Manoah. And his wife was barren, and bare not. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto the woman, and said unto her, "Behold now, thou art barren, bearest not, but thou shalt conceive, and bear a son. Now therefore beware, I pray thee, and drink not wine nor strong drink, and eat not any unclean thing, for lo, thou shalt conceive, and bear a son, and no razor shall come on his head, for the child shall be a Nazarite unto God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines." Verse 24. "And the woman bare a son, called his name Samson. And the child grew, and the Lord blessed him. And the Spirit of the Lord began to move him at times in the camp of Dan, between Zorah and Eshtaol. And Samson went down to Timnath, and saw a woman in Timnath of the daughters of the Philistines. He came up and told his father and his mother, and said, 'I have seen a woman in Timnath of the daughters of the Philistines. Now therefore get her for me to wife.' Then his father and his mother said unto him, 'Is there never a woman among the daughters of thy brethren, or among all my people, that thou goest to take a wife of the uncircumcised Philistines?' Samson said unto his father, 'Get her for me, for she pleaseth me well,' or more literally, 'for she is right in my eyes.' But his father and his mother knew not that it was of the Lord that he sought an occasion against the Philistines. For at that time the Philistines had dominion over Israel. Then went Samson down, and his father and mother, to Timnath, and came to the vineyards of Timnath, and behold, a young lion roared against him, and the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and he rent him as he would have rent a kid, and he had nothing in his hand. But he told not his father or his mother what he had done. And he went down and talked with the woman, and she pleased Samson well, literally, and she was right in Samson's eyes. And then in chapter 16, please, and verse 15. Judges 16, verse 15. "And Delilah said unto him, How canst thou say, I love thee, when thine heart is not with me? Thou hast mocked me these 3 times, and hast not told me wherein thy great strength lieth. And it came to pass, when she pressed him daily with her words, and urged him, so that his soul was vexed unto death, that he told her all his heart, and said unto her, there hath not come a razor upon mine head, for I have been a Nazarite unto God from my mother's womb. If I be shaven, then my strength will go from me, and I shall become weak, and be like other men. When Delilah saw that he had told her all his heart, she sent and called for the lords of the Philistines, saying, come up this once, for he hath showed me all his heart. And the lords of the Philistines came up unto her, and brought money in their hand. And she made him sleep upon her knees, and she called for a man, and she caused him to shave off the 7 locks of his head. And she began to afflict him, and his strength went from him. And she said, the Philistines be upon thee, Samson! And he woke out of his sleep and said, I will go out as at other times before and shake myself. And he knew not that the Lord was departed from him. But the Philistines took him and put out his eyes and brought him down to Gaza and bound him with fetters of brass, and he did grind in the prison house. Howbeit, the hair of his head began to grow again after he was shaven. Then the lords of the Philistines gathered them together for to offer a great sacrifice unto Dagon their god, and to rejoice, for they said, our God hath delivered Samson our enemy into our hand. Verse 27. Now the house was full of men and women, and all the lords of the Philistines were there. And there were upon the roof about 3,000 men and women that beheld while Samson made sport. And Samson called unto the Lord and said, O Lord God, remember me, I pray thee, and strengthen me, I pray thee, only this once, O God, that I may be at once avenged of the Philistines for my 2 eyes. And Samson took hold of the 2 middle pillars upon which the house stood and on which it was borne up, of the one with his right hand and of the other with his left. And Samson said, let me die with the Philistines. And he bowed himself with all his might. And the house fell upon the lords and upon all the people that were therein. So the dead which he slew at his death were more than they which he slew in his life. And that's all I plan reading tonight from the Bible. And as the title of the book indicates, the book of Judges is concerned with the lives of a series of ancient leaders in Israel known as Judges, of which the book mentions 10 in all. But when we come to the case of Samson, there are several unique features which stand out, both about the man himself and the account which is given of his life. And these unusual features raise several interesting questions about the significance which Samson had for the people of Israel in his day. Let's get the features first, and then we'll pass on. Thinking first of the narrative, we note that Samson's history is not only recorded the last, but it provides by far the fullest account, the fullest portrait of any of the judges. Although the life of Samson actually accomplished relatively little, his story is recorded in far more detail than other stories of the other judges, number one. Number two, Samson comes on the scene at a time when the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and were delivered by him, as a result, into the hand of the Philistines. Nothing new, of course, for God to raise up a deliverer following a period of oppression. But what is different, what is unique in this case, is that the people did not first cry to God for his help. Even though the Philistine oppression was both the longest and seemingly the most extensive in terms of territory of any that Israel endured, in the case of each of the other major judges, there was first an outcry to God, begging him to intervene, to deliver his people from their suffering. Alone among the judges, therefore, Samson was not raised up in response to the pleading of the people, and so marks a clean break in the cycle which has run through the rest of the book. A cycle which is stated succinctly in Nehemiah 9, it's verse 27, says of Israel, they worked great provocations. Therefore, you delivered them into the hand of their enemies who oppressed them. And in the time of their trouble, when they cried to you, you heard from heaven. And according to your abundant mercies, you gave them deliverers who saved them from the hand of their enemies. That's the normal practice. Not this time. That God took the initiative alone in the case of Samson suggests strongly that there was something which he wanted to accomplish and possibly to say through Samson's life and experience. Number three. Samson's story begins with a detailed account of the prior announcement of his conception and birth. That fills 23 verses in chapter 13. An announcement made by no less a personage than the angel of the Lord himself. And that stands in marked contrast to the histories of the judges that came before him, whose births aren't even mentioned, except that in the case of Jephthah, we are told he was born illegitimately, but it's a passing comment. The histories of the other judges commence with their call to service when mature in life. So clearly there's something about Samson's birth which was of special significance. And fourthly, Samson's story ends with a detailed account of his death. We know nothing of the circumstances of the death of any of the other judges. We're simply told they died and they were buried. So clearly there was something also about the circumstances of Samson's death, which were of special significance. Thinking now of the man himself, we discover, number one, that Samson never went to war against the enemy. Nor did he attempt to raise or rally an army in Israel to do that. Indeed, it's all too clear in Samson's case that Israel had no stomach whatever for a fight with the Philistines. I've already mentioned the fact they didn't even cry to God for their deliverance. And when at one stage Samson provoked the Philistines, he'd set fire to their standing corn and avenged his wife and father-in-law in a rather bloodthirsty manner, his own people protested to him, "Don't you know
that the Philistines are rulers over us? What's this you've done to us? Not what's this you've done to them. What's this you've done to us?
They didn't want to know any about battle. Samson did not lead Israel into war against the oppressors, as did the other judges. Now, true. Samson fought the Philistines. Of course he did. But in an altogether different way from that in which the other judges fought against their oppressors. The other judges delivered Israel by their leadership, by their courage, Gideon, man, mighty man of valor, by their force of character. Not by any personal strength or prowess, but Samson worked solely by himself. Samson didn't lead an army. He was an army. And he put paid to large numbers of the Philistines by his singular feats of strength. And secondly, Samson only began to deliver Israel. Oh yes, he certainly did that. And did it well enough. He proved to be a terrifying scourge to the Philistines, dispatching in chapter 14, 30 men at Ashkelon. In chapter 15, an unquantified number in that hip and thigh slaughter. And 1,000 went down at Lehi. And vastly in excess of 3,000 at his death in Gaza in chapter 16. And yet, we are told plainly he only began. That is, whereas each of the other judges accomplished a complete deliverance for Israel, Samson didn't. In the cases of judges like Ehud, Deborah, Gideon, Jephthah, we read that through them, and I quote God, he subdued Israel's enemies, Moab, Jabin, king of Canaan, Midian, and the children of Ammon, respectively. It's in chapters 3, 4, 8, and 11. But Samson didn't subdue the Philistines. It fell to Samuel to do that. And it was following the victory which Samuel helped to achieve at Mizpah that we read. So the Philistines were subdued. That's 1 Samuel 7. So for his part, Samson was only a partial deliverer. Now taken together, these interesting features alert us to the fact that there was something mighty odd about the story of Samson. And they invite us to ask some very serious questions about the significance of his life and experience. And we're going to find it critically important that we understand where and how Samson fits into the events of his day. According to our first verse in chapter 13 of Judges, the Philistine oppression lasted 40 years. This oppression began very shortly before Samson's birth. And Samson's life runs more or less parallel with the duration of that tyranny. His role as judge commenced when he approached 20 years of age. And it lasted for a further 20 years. More or less matching exactly the period between the Battle of Aphek, recorded in 1 Samuel 4, when Israel was roundly defeated and the Ark of God captured by the Philistines, and the Battle of Mizpah in 1 Samuel 7, when Israel enjoyed a decisive victory over the Philistines. Let me say it again. Samson's public work for God more or less matched the period between the Battle of Aphek in 1 Samuel 4 and the Battle of Mizpah at 1 Samuel 7. At some time about the beginning of the Philistine oppression, two very remarkable boys were born in Israel. They were given the names Samson and Samuel. They were both miracle babies, being conceived supernaturally. For both of their mothers, the Spirit of God tells us, had not only previously been childless, but were barren. The boys were both to be Nazarites for the whole of their lifetime. And the public symbol, the tangible evidence of their consecration to God, was their long hair. Before Samson was conceived, his mother-to-be was informed by God that no razor may be used on his head. Before Samuel was conceived, his mother-to-be vowed to God that no razor will ever be used on his head. That's 1 Samuel 1:11. I didn't read it. Both men began their public work for God shortly before the disastrous battle at Aphek. Both are said more than once to have judged Israel. And both get honorable mention in the very same verse in that great catalogue of faith in Hebrews 11, is verse 32. But, as we've seen, Samson only began to deliver Israel from the Philistines. It was left to Samuel to finish the job and end the Philistine occupation of Israel, which he did at the Battle of Mizpah of 1 Samuel 7. Alas, the one, Samson, later defiled his consecration. In that, as a result of his own folly, his hair was shaved off, and he died blind and with no descendants of which we know, just a short time before Israel's decisive victory over the Philistines. The other, Samuel, preserved his consecration to God intact. He played a key role in Israel's decisive victory, and he went on to live for about 40 years after that. And we read about his descendants for many generations to come, in particular of his 17 great-grandchildren, of whom at least 14 were accomplished musicians. But I tell you, it must have been murder living next door to that family, because the Bible says they all played the horn. I don't know what the horn looked like. I have a good idea how it sounded, and I guess it made a lot more noise than Tom's mouth organs. And you get 14 of them going at the same time, I'd have moved. And if we are going to grasp the significance and lesson of Samson's life, it's my opinion, it's all important that we remember that the key events of that life, involving both his strength and his weakness, were sandwiched between the two battles which marked Israel's great defeat and Israel's great victory. So what then is the special significance of Samson's life? Superficial glance, it might seem to be no more than that God was determined to prove that though his people may have been defeated, and his ark may have been taken briefly into captivity by the Philistines, he was still very much in control. He retained the power to help his people and to smite his foes. And all that is most certainly and most wonderfully true. But I suggest there was a much deeper, a far more important meaning to Samson's checkered experiences than proving that. If I'd read the whole of chapters 14 and 15, you'd have been here a long time. But apart from that, we would have discovered
that Samson had a liking for riddles and rhymes. A lion and bees and a heifer and jawbone of an ass and heaps and all things like that. But in a way, Samson was himself a riddle. A curious mixture of great strengths and great weaknesses. And I'm suggesting tonight that the chief significance of Samson's exploits and actions lay in that he was meant to be a living object lesson for his generation. That the nation's very own character and history was itself embodied. It was being played out in the story of this man's mingled strength and weakness. Now we noticed at the outset that Samson was distinguished from the other judges in that he was raised up by God without the people having first cried out to God in their afflictions, even though those afflictions were extremely severe. Samson's appearance on the stage was the result of the sovereign intervention of God, and I believe that the Lord not only chose this particular man to be a leader in Israel, but that he deliberately made him the unusual kind of leader that he was, working alone in the supernatural strength which God supplied, in contrast to the other judges who led armies into battle, because God meant Israel to see, and he meant Malcolm to see, but Samson himself provides a vivid picture of Israel's own experience at that very time. For on the one hand, Samson exerted a supernatural power not dissimilar from that which would have been the constant experience of God's people if, but only if, they remained true to their covenant vow to God and continued in wholehearted consecration to Him. But on the other hand, when Samson defiled and compromised his consecration, he forfeited God's power. He became weak as other men, as he so foolishly disclosed to Delilah. And this fact cried out loud and clear to Israel that their supernatural strength too was entirely conditional on their consecration to the Lord. For in the event Samson failed to deliver the people completely from the oppression of the enemy, in contrast to the success of every one of the earlier judges, and it was due entirely to his unfaithfulness to his Nazarite vow, and his resulting premature death. What a waste. What an awful waste. What unfulfilled potential. But in precisely the same way, Israel, through their spiritual unfaithfulness to their covenant with God, had lost their power against the enemy. Hence, that disastrous, that humiliating defeat at Aphek. And the outcome of that battle had demonstrated beyond doubt to them that there was no substitute whatever for God's presence and power. The people had then trusted in the ark of the Lord to secure victory for them. "It will save us," was their battle cry. But just as with Samson, they didn't know. They didn't realize that the Lord had departed from them. And they soon found to their cost that their strength lay only not in the ark of the Lord, but the Lord of the ark, and he was no longer among them. And I suggest that God raised up Samson to this unique kind of judgeship, that he might be a fitting picture of a people who were invincible in God's strength, but who were weak and totally ineffective without it. Now I need at this time to stop and correct the popular but false impression that Samson was a man of outstanding physique, perpetuated by endless children's Bibles, endowed with huge, rippling muscles, the sort of character who lived in the gymnasium. Because it's quite clear that left to himself, Samson was no stronger than any other man, which is why in chapter 16, his enemies were completely baffled by the secret and source of his strength. Nothing they could see. Although they were in no doubt about the secret and source of his weakness. Because although they didn't know where his strength lay, they knew something just as important, namely where his weakness lay, in his romantic liaisons with foreign women, which they exploited to the full. Samson then certainly was not a man of giant stature and proportions, as were at least one family of the Philistines, as it happens. I speak of the family of Rapha, of Gath, of whom Goliath, I suppose, is the most famous member. Right then, make no mistake then. It wasn't Samson's build or biceps which accounted for his exceptional strength. It was the Spirit of God. And the Spirit of God alone who made Samson strong. From the time when that Spirit first moved him, began to move, began to stir, began to rouse, disturb him, at the end of chapter 13, and from that moment, Samson possessed superhuman strength, sufficient for most circumstances. For instance, that hip and thigh slaughter of chapter 15. For instance, transporting the gate of Gaza to the top of a mountain in the direction of Hebron. Hebron's 40 miles as the crow flies from Gaza. I don't know where the mountain was, but it was somewhere along that 40-mile route. And he carried the gate of Gaza. And to carry the gate of Gaza was particularly humiliating to the city of Gaza. Because the gate, in the Bible, is a symbol of a city's strength and power. Samson carted their gate off for them. That supernatural strength was sufficient for most circumstances, like demolishing the temple of Dagon in chapter 16. Yet there were occasions which called for special empowerment. And we read in the book of Judges on three occasions, the Spirit came upon him mightily. Two in chapter 14, one in chapter 15, not time to stop. So in the final analysis, it wasn't Samson's arm or fist or a jawbone of an ass for that matter with which he defeated the Philistines. It was the power of God's Spirit alone which made him mightier than thousands of his enemies. I hope you're following the argument. You've got to keep with this. File that away for now. But in exactly the same way, the tribes of Israel were no bigger or more impressive than the other nations around them. Far from it. For in almost every case, they were hopelessly outnumbered by their enemies and far less well equipped for warfare. Indeed, in the days of Samson, and it was true also of Samuel and Saul, the Philistines enjoyed an enormous advantage over Israel because the Philistines maintained a monopoly in smelting iron
And an iron sword would slice through a sword of bronze, which is what the people of Israel had. So there wasn't really a level playing field. Now clearly Samson experienced no special sensations, he experienced no physical indications to tell him that he possessed superhuman strength. That's why in chapter 16, he knew not that the Lord was departed from him. Go out, shake myself, and I'll flatten them. He didn't know, because there was nothing, there were no tingles, there was nothing that told him physically that he possessed superhuman strength. He knew that he had such strength only when he used it. But he knew one thing. He was in absolutely no doubt about the nature and the source of that strength. When he'd slain 1,000 Philistines with this jawbone of an ass, he became very thirsty. He called on the Lord, saying, I'm quoting from chapter 15, it's verse 18. He called on the Lord, saying, you have given this great deliverance by the hand of your servant. Now shall I die of thirst? Oh, he knew all right where he got his power. He knew full well that his strength was not his own. It wasn't inherent. It was supplied, and supplied constantly by God. He knew that. But Samson's strength wasn't only an imparted strength. From the very beginning, it had been bound up inseparably with his faithfulness to his Nazarite vow. And Samson knew that. Samson's mother had told him that. Samson was fully aware of the inseparable link between his supernatural power and his loyalty and faithfulness to his vow and his consecration to God. He later confided in Delilah, as you've read, I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. If I am shaven, then my strength will go from me and I shall be weak like any other man. And the outward expressions of this man's Nazariteship, which affected his appetites, not eating or drinking anything which came from the vine. It affected his appearance with his conspicuously long hair, and it affected his associations, because he was permitted no contact with any human corpse. The lion's okay. No human dead body. But these outward expressions of his Nazariteship, which I've collected, of course, from number 6, is slightly different. Number 6 was a short-term Nazarite vow. Samson was a Nazarite all his life. But those were the features of a Nazarite. And they were a constant, they were indeed a daily reminder to the man of that very simple fact. That his supernatural power, you listening, was altogether conditional. And the same held true for Israel. As Moses had made clear to the nation in Deuteronomy 28, before they ever entered the promised land, listen to the man. I quote his words. It shall come to pass, if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments which I command you today, that the Lord will cause your enemies who rise against you to be defeated before your face. They shall come out against you one way, and they'll flee before you seven ways. Israel were on all fours with Samson. And Samson was then a most graphic picture to the Israel of his day, if only they had had the eyes to see it, of the strength which they, as the people of God, could and should have exerted in overcoming the very strongest of their foes on condition that they adhered faithfully to their covenant vow and their consecration to the Lord. But Samson was an equally graphic picture of the weakness which the nation so often confronted and experienced on account of their waywardness, through their unfaithfulness to God, through their sustained intercourse with the heathen. And we can't miss it, that in fact...